From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, it's all about you and your economic future. A special series of interviews on the bailout. Search and rescue teams are climbing high into a mountainous area of Madera County to hunt for the remains of millionaire aviator Stephen Fawcett, whose identification papers were found over the weekend near Mammoth Lakes. A local hiker said he found three ID cards issued to Fawcett by the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Aeronautic Association. They are the very first solid signs of the 63-year-old adventurer since he disappeared on September 3rd, 2007, after taking off for a pleasure flight from a private airport south of Reno, Nevada. As you know, Major Ed Dames and his group of remote viewers have been trying to find the location, the whereabouts of Stephen Fawcett. Ed Dames provided information to us and to some of those who were searching for Fawcett many, many months ago. If you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, you'll look at the map of where these identification cards were found. You'll also see the point, the coordinates that Major Ed Dames passed on to us and also to the researchers. Only about 45 miles separates the two spots. Here he is now, Ed Dames. Ed, welcome to Coast. Hello, Ed.
Thank you, George. Good evening.
Okay, good. Now, Ed, 45, 50 miles from the spot where these ID cards were found, I've got to tell you, that's not too bad.
That's close enough for government work, maybe, but not for me. We don't think that the things that were found on the ground have any connection with the crash whatsoever, George.
Now, they tell us the ID cards could be Fawcett's. Don't they know for sure?
Well, I'm not sure, but it's irrelevant in terms of the wreckage and the crash as far as we're concerned. I think they probably could be Fawcett's. There's a note on the Internet somewhere that he had a home near Mammoth Lakes, which I did not know about. So he could have been walking a dog or something like that 2 years ago and lost these things. Remember, he has many, many pilot's license for many, many different types of aircrafts.
It is unusual, Ed, that if indeed these are his identification cards and for some reason he may have escaped this crash unharmed originally, or he was injured somewhat and maybe wandered around, but you would think that the wreckage would be very close by.
George, again, I don't think there's any connection. I believe there's no connection whatsoever with the wreckage and those documents. In fact, the discovery of those documents is beyond, to say it's uncanny is an understatement. That is beyond me. But we believe there's no connection whatsoever. Where my team leader James, who was underwater on the Natalie Holloway case and Aruba and many other cases, is going in on October 10th to our site, which again Lex has posted on your website.
Okay, Major Ed Dames, thank you so much. I still think 45 miles is pretty darn good. It's pretty close. After one spectacular failure, the $700 billion financial industry bailout found a second life, winning lopsided passage in the Senate, gaining ground in the House, where Republicans' opposition softened. Senators loaded the economic rescue bill with tax breaks and other sweeteners before passing it by a wide margin, 74-25, a month before the presidential and congressional elections. In the House, leaders were working feverishly to convert enough opponents of the bill to push it through by Friday, just days after lawmakers there stunningly rejected an earlier version and sent markets plunging around the globe. The measure didn't cause the same uproar in the Senate. Now, opposition overall appeared to be easing after the Senate added $110 billion in tax breaks for businesses and the middle class, plus a provision to raise from $100,000 to $250,000 the cap on the federal deposit insurance. We will have a special report next hour on this entire situation. Tight credit, economic worries, and high gasoline prices combined to crush the sales of U.S. and foreign automakers alike last month. Ford Motor Company, Toyota, Chrysler, all posting drops of more than 30%. Beleaguered Ford reported a 34% decline. It was Ford's worst sales month this year. General Motors pushed up by its offer of employee pricing on most of its vehicles, saw its U.S. sales drop a less severe 16%. If there is ever another anthrax attack in the United States, the mailman may deliver antibiotics to you. The U.S. government health officials are beginning a project in Minneapolis-St. Paul to let letter carriers stockpile a personal supply of emergency antibiotics so they are protected and ready to go deliver aid to the rest of the city at a moment's notice. Vitamin C supplements may substantially reduce the benefit from a wide range of anti-cancer drugs, according to research now. They say that 30 to 70% less cancer cells in a lab were killed by a range of drugs after pretreatment with vitamin C. In Los Angeles, federal investigators are saying the engineer of a commuter train sent a text message just seconds before a deadly collision last month in Los Angeles. Now, a day or so after this incident, they realized that he did send a text message. But now they're saying this was done just seconds before the collision. The National Transportation Safety Board said that the cell phone records of Robert Sanchez show that he received a text message a minute and 20 seconds before the crash. The agency says he sent one about a minute later. An East Tennessee school bus driver was charged with driving under the influence after her vehicle with 30 children inside was found stopped in the middle of a street. Loudoun Police Chief James Webb said 48-year-old Vicki Lynn Quasney was found passed out behind the wheel. My gosh. It's going to be a stormy month, according to the forecasters for the Atlanta Hurricane Tracking Centers based at Colorado State University. The October-only forecast calls for three named storms, two hurricanes, one major hurricane. They write this on their website. A test spacecraft for Europe's future satellite navigation system has been rocked by a surge of space radiation. The incident forced the satellite to adopt a safe mode for 2 weeks in which only essential power systems were kept running. Hidden over 900 feet beneath the surface of the Earth is one of the greatest natural marvels on the planet, a giant crystal cave discovered by miners in November of 2000 at a small desert town in Mexico. The cave contains crystals ranging from, get this, 36 feet long, 55 tons, or as high as telephone poles and 100 times as heavy. But at 113 degree temperatures and humidity at 100%, humans could die after just 15 minutes of exposure. The big questions, of course, what are the crystals made of? Why are they so big? How old are they? And is there life there? In a moment, Chris McKay joins us, a planetary scientist, on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Chris McKay, currently a planetary scientist with the Space Science Division of NASA Ames Research Center. Chris is a co-investigator on the Titan probe atmospheric structure experiment and has been actively involved in planning for future Mars missions, including human settlements. Can't wait for the day when that happens. Dr. McKay recently traveled to the Siberian Arctic to conduct research in this Mars-like environment as well. Here he is, Chris McKay. Doctor, how are you?
Very good, George. Good to be on with you.
Likewise. Tell me a little bit about this crystal cave. 55 tons? That's incredible.
Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. It's deep underground. It's in an area that's volcanically active, and it's normally flooded. But there's a mine there mining silver and other things. And to make the mine usable, they're pumping the water out. And one of the things that they've discovered as they were excavating the mountain is this huge chamber that had been flooded. It was now dry. Huge chamber, and inside it they found crystals the size of huge trees. Imagine them lying on their side, crystal clear, beautiful. They're made out of a material called gypsum, and they formed over millions of years slowly in this hot, underground, wet, flooded chamber. And now we're studying them to try to understand how they formed, when they formed, and did they trap the microbial life that may have been in the water, entombing it in the crystal? And can we use this as a model for searching for evidence of life preserved in minerals on other worlds?
Do you think there are other regions on this planet where we have crystals like this deep underground?
There might be. This would never have been discovered unless that mining operation was vigorously pumping water out of that mountainside. So there may be other places where there's been essentially slow percolating hot water dissolving minerals and then reprecipitating them underground in huge chambers that would be virtually undiscoverable unless some reason we were doing operations in that area.
You imagine what this must look like, Chris, if you can go down there. I know it's hot, 113 degrees, and the humidity is saturated. But if you could go down there, beam some light down there, it must look incredible. It must look like diamonds all over the place.
We went down there. There's a television special that's coming out about our explorations of this cave. We went into this cave with special suits on to keep us cool. If you're not in a special suit, you will pass out literally in 10 minutes in this environment. It is so hot and so humid, it's like being in a pressure cooker. But with special suits on, with cooling, active cooling, we could stay in there longer and do some work. We took instruments in to analyze the interior of the crystals without breaking into them, using remote sensing instruments so that we could figure out what's in them without having to destroy these beautiful crystals. And there was a film crew in there from National Geographic filming us doing this. So it was really quite interesting. And just being in that cave, I can remember my first step in there. The first impression is one of just sort of the bodily reaction to being in an environment that's hostile. You think, oh my God, this is a lethal environment. And then that passes because you know you're in a protective suit. And then the next emotion that hits you is, oh my gosh, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, seeing these huge, clear crystals. And then that passes, and then finally I kick in as a scientist and say, okay, I'm here to study it. Let me get my instrument out. Let me take some measurements. So it's sort of a fear reaction, an awe reaction, and then a curiosity-driven reaction. So it's a sort of a welling up of emotions in there.
Well, you can see these giant crystals, this cave specifically, October 12th, 9 o'clock Eastern Time, Pacific Time, on the National Geographic Channel. That must have been a fascinating documentary. I feel sorry for the camera crew, Chris, when they went down there. By gosh!
Right, right. They're in there trying to make this film. It's really, it was heroic. It was really quite something.
Are you still doing some work on Mars?
Yeah, well, I'm part of the Phoenix mission, and we're digging away there in a very cold, very dry environment, sort of the opposite of the cave. But in a sense, our goal is the same, the search for evidence of past life that's trapped inside a mineral. In this case, the mineral might be ice, and to try to understand how that environment might have been habitable.
You must all be amazed that the rovers continue to do what they do.
Yeah, they're just going and going and going. They're like the little bunny rabbit that just won't quit. That's really good. Unfortunately, for the polar region, the lander, Phoenix, it's going to get buried in CO2 when winter comes. The rovers benefit by being near the equator.
Right.
So they're
right.
Lucky.
But with Phoenix, what do you expect? I mean, is it going to die then?
It's going to freeze. It's going to, it's already starting to snow in that place. Winter's coming fast, and winter's going to be really cold. It's going to be snow like dry ice, of course, and the temperatures are going to get down to minus a couple hundred, and that thing is going to freeze solid. And that's not good for electronics or batteries, and so it's very, very unlikely that it will come back to life again next summer, which would be almost 2 Earth years from now. So that it'll go out, it'll freeze in place, and it'll still be there thousands of years later.
Tell me a little bit about the snow on Mars. How can this be?
Well, what's going to happen is as winter comes, there's going to be snow forming. There'll be a little bit of water snow, ice snow, like we have here on Earth. But then as winter really comes hard, that lander is going to get buried in carbon dioxide snow. So where the Phoenix lander is standing will eventually be buried in about 6 feet of dry ice. Now, my guess is that the lander itself, its internal heat will prevent it from getting buried, and it'll be surrounded by this material, but sort of free of it, sort of like a dark rock in a sea of snow. But it's going to be very cold. The temperatures that lander will experience, it will be cold soaked down to minus 120 centigrade, which is minus a couple hundred Fahrenheit. So it's colder than any place on Earth.
Chris, what does your gut tell you about the possibility of some kind of life on Mars? Any kind of life?
Well, what we see evidence of Mars clearly is liquid water. There was liquid water on Mars. And one lesson we learned from studying life on Earth is liquid water is the defining ecological requirement. Everything else, life can work around. But the limits of life are the limits of liquid water. So that's why we're on a follow-the-water strategy, and Mars shows us that there was liquid water. So I think there was life there.
You've worked on the missions for possible human settlements. Has that been pushed back? Are we still on time?
Well, we're going to go to Mars. Humans are going to go to Mars. We'll probably go to the moon first. It makes sense to learn how to do it on the moon first. The moon's closer, it's easier, it's safer, and it's also an interesting place. Eventually, we're going to have a research base on the moon. My interest is Mars and the search for life. Eventually, we'll go do that too, but it's going to take some time, and you know, with fiscal problems and other challenges, I think it's going to be a patience game.
Tell me a little bit about what the mood is about the Chinese and the fact that they just conducted their first spacewalk. They seem to be coming along at a pretty good clip with the latest technologies. And, of course, we did this a long time ago, 40-plus years ago. We did all these things with older technology. But the fact that they keep coming along, how rapid can they catch up to us, Chris?
Well, that's a really good question, and how we will respond to that is also an interesting question. So far, they haven't done anything that, in a sense, is threatening the U.S. leadership in space. We have the most extensive exploration program in the solar system, the most capable human exploration program. We have the most ambitious plans for humans going to the moon and Mars. We're still way out in front of any sort of competition. But like you say, the Chinese are coming on fast. They've done in a couple years what the U.S. and Soviet Union back in the 60s took many, many years to do. So if they continue at this accelerating pace, they may be, in a sense, going back to the moon themselves or going to the moon themselves before we go back. So it could generate a sense of we're in a race again, or it could generate a sense of, well, let's cooperate. Let's, you go there and we'll go here and we'll all explore this interesting moon and we'll all prepare to go to Mars. And kind of like the way we do Antarctica now. You know, we all have bases, many nations have bases in Antarctica, but there's no sense of a race. There's very much a sense of cooperation. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Would you consider it a defeat for us if the Chinese get to the moon before we can get back the technically second time?
Well, I wouldn't think of it as a defeat, especially if we're doing other things. Like, for example, we might defer establishing a moon base and instead send humans out to visit an asteroid, something that could potentially be a hazard, just to show that we could do it, just to show that if we had to, we could send the folks out there and rendezvous with an asteroid. That would be interesting. If we were doing that, the Chinese were going to the moon, I don't think we'd have anything to be ashamed of in that comparison. Or if we were doing some more ambitious Mars programs like a sample return, leading up to developing technologies for human exploration, in addition to planning for the moon base, we could have an active program that would be something we could be proud of that would be different from what the Chinese are doing, and in a way complementary to it. And then eventually let them mature their technology base so that when we establish outposts at the south pole of the moon, they're ready to join us. That would be cool.
I sure would. Hey, good luck with the Giant Crystal Cave program, which again premieres Sunday, October 12th, 9 o'clock Eastern Pacific Time on the National Geographic Channel. Did you know that off the coast of Hawaii, there exists a floating mass of trash twice the size of Texas? In a moment, we're going to talk about that. And also, we're taking your phone calls about planet Earth. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, a special roundtable discussion about the bailout. When we come back, Thomas Costigan joins us as we talk about the Green Book. And also, you are here, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Thomas Costigan is co-author of the Green Book. He writes with the Ethics Monitor column for Dow Jones Market Watch and the Better Planet column and blog for Discover Magazine. He's a longtime journalist, former Bloomberg News editor, and he's been writing about global warming, the environment, social issues, and government policies for two decades. Also this hour, we will take your calls specifically about the issue at hand. Thomas, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Thank you, and I'd also like to mention my new book, You Are Here, Exposing the Vital Link Between What We Do and What That Does to the Planet.
You Are Here. Sounds like an old Walter Cronkite TV show.
Yeah.
That one was called You Are There.
Yeah.
Tom.
And just one quick note, it's Costigan.
Costigan.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your impression of the state of this planet right now, environmentally.
Well, I think we're at a very precarious place right now because we have so much strain on all of our natural resources. If you look around, we're in the middle of a water crisis, we're in the middle of a food crisis, we're in the middle of an energy crisis, not to mention all sorts of pollution that's wandering around the air and the toxins that we constantly find in our food and in other products such as lead paint and toys and even radioactive wood material that's coming back to haunt us. So I think we really have to start to think about what we do and what that does to the planet in a very, very serious way, because there's just so many people looking for so many or so few natural resources. It's just a basic law of supply and demand.
Tell us a little bit about what is off the coast of Hawaii now, this floating mass of trash.
Yeah, there's something there called the Eastern Garbage Patch, which I was surprised to find. And it's actually, I didn't find it. I went along with the lead research vessel that was trawling it. And it's an area at least twice the size of Texas, filled with man-made refuse. And largely from our rivers and our streams, and when things float off the shore, they end up in our currents and end up in this vortex. And this vortex holds this floating mass of garbage, if you will, and so much so that there is now six times as much plastic in this area as there is zooplankton. And zooplankton is an amazingly important fish food for all sorts of marine life. So it's really kind of a shocking development that's occurring in the seas. Right now there's about 46,000 pieces of trash on every square mile of the ocean. Which really shows us what we're doing to our seas as well as what we're doing to land. And you have to keep in mind that the seas comprise 70% of the space on Earth and are home to 90% of all life. So without the oceans, we perish.
And I understand, like, birds have been found with syringes sticking out of their stomachs, toothbrushes caught in their mouths.
Yes, so much so that their albatross are now becoming endangered, and several hundred thousand porpoises every year are killed, and you know, even as big a mammal as whales. So what happens is that this plastic is very confusing for seabirds and for other marine life, and they ingest it, thinking that it's food. You know, it's shiny, it's floating around in the water. They go, oh, all right, that looks like something I can eat, and they ingest it. And eventually, as we all know, we end up ingesting those fish right back into us. So this full circle of what we do and what that does really does come back to haunt us.
Why can't we clean up the oceans, clean up that part of the environment? Is there just no way?
Yeah, it's just so, so vast. You have to remember the Pacific Ocean itself, we could take all the land on Earth, and it still would not fill the size of the Pacific Ocean. And many places we don't even know how deep it is. So all the navies in all the world would not be able to vacuum clean it, even if they had the capabilities. It's just too much, and this material is so diffuse at this point that it is broken down and degraded way past the horizon line, which is the kind of stable carbon sink for the planet. And there's just no way to clean it up. The best we can do is just stop putting more in it.
Is that really possible? Do you think this planet will do that?
I don't think we'll stop producing things, but I do think, or consuming things as much as we do, but I do think that there is a movement such as biostarches, other sustainable products that are starting to come into play for economic purposes, because we have to remember that plastics, the thing that holds them together, is petroleum. And because petroleum is becoming very expensive, people are looking for alternatives. And, you know, an easy alternative is starch. And when those things start to come into play, then we have a real sustainable equation that even if you throw something out, we know that it's not going to be as bad for the planet as plastic doesn't degrade for hundreds of years.
You know, a long time ago on television, they would have commercials of a Native American standing by the side of a road. Somebody would litter, and, you know, you'd see that tear coming down his cheek. It's got to be pretty upsetting to people who truly love this planet to see things like this happening on such a scale. I mean, I get upset when I see someone throw a bag of something out of a car. I can imagine how you feel when you see these truly huge, huge environmental calamities.
Yes, then, you know, the Native American crying by the side of the highway is iconic, and I think we need that type of wake-up call again. And you're right, you know, there is a visceral response when we see someone litter or when we see someone do something that's just foul, and we have to think of it that way, as fouling the planet. And it's not just for moral reasons, but there's also real health reasons associated with this that comes back to haunt us. When we litter, we're putting a lot more toxins into the ground and into our groundwater and into the air. And, you know, I really look at the whole basket of natural resources rather than just energy, because I think that's the problem these days. We get so wrapped up in this cause celeb of global warming and alternative energy, we forget about the water, the food, and the land that we need in order to just survive. So if we can take part of the political equation out of this and just look at it from, you know, a realist perspective and a practical perspective, we have to start to think of it in terms that we can deal with and then put some real muscle to it and create efficiencies that will allow us to have fresh water for everybody so that a child under the age of 5 doesn't die every 12 seconds because of a lack of access to fresh water, not because it doesn't exist, because of a lack of access.
We're
2008. We should have the capabilities to get water to people at this point.
You would think so. Really would. We're finding frogs, 2 heads, 3 legs, polar bears having male and female sexual organs, mm-hmm. honeybees disappearing because of pesticides, I believe, and who knows what else. They are the front line, I think, before we truly get hit here as human beings. It's showing us, the planet is telling us, there's something wrong, folks. Yet really not a lot of people are paying attention.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, you're absolutely right. When you get down to the frogs start dying, I mean, that's the makings of, you know, science fiction movies, because they're really susceptible to the atmosphere and changes in it into our ecosystem. You know, any amphibian creatures and, you know, fish especially, they're very, very susceptible to changes like that. Now, what happens when that floor starts to fall away underneath us? We start to lose the ground beneath our feet. Pretty soon, we're in trouble. So it is a scary proposition, and I really think we need more wake-up calls, but I don't know what more of a wake-up call there can be than Katrina, than the recent tragedies in Galveston, than, you know, troubles overseas in Bangladesh and faraway places where we see this occurring. I mean, I've been to places where the land is eroding and the coast is eroding and displacing cultures that have lived on it for thousands of years up in the Arctic Circle. I mean, it's really shocking when you see it up close, but it's happening. And for whatever reason, it's not sticking so much to the point where we're going to have great legislation on the government level, we're going to have changes in the business community level, and we're going to have shifts in habit on a personal level. And it's going to take all those three things in order to make change or affect change.
Let's go to the phones east of the Rockies. Philip, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, George, it's a pleasure.
Sure thing.
Look, I was in the Navy, stationed on Diego Garcia. I'm sure you know where that is.
Yes.
You're talking 2,000 miles from anywhere. There's trash. We used to, once a week, clean the outer edge of the island. there would be plastics and pieces of clothing and just anything you can imagine. So this has got to be something worldwide, right?
Oh, it absolutely is a worldwide problem. And, there's not only the eastern garbage patch that floats between San Francisco and Hawaii. There's also a western garbage patch that's off the coast of Japan that's even more concentrated in terms of pollution. And between the two is a super funnel, or what they call the super tunnel of trash, where we share our garbage with Asia. And in between sits the Hawaiian Islands, and the Hawaiian Islands act as a comb for the patch. So I actually went out to Camillo Beach, which is just past South Point on the Big Island, the southernmost point of the United States, and I saw firsthand detergent bottles from Korea, whiskey bottles from Japan, other pieces of plastic from Russia, other pieces, from all over, and you can tell by the handwriting. I mean, it's really, really amazing how much we're connected and we push our garbage and our waste all over the world. So you're absolutely right, sir. It does occur in every single ocean and every single sea. And we dump, cities dump, 90 cities in the United States dump storage into the Great Lakes today.
What about simple trash removal, for example, Thomas, here in this country, where, they dump this stuff in landfills? I mean, aren't we going to run out of space eventually?
Well, we have right now each of the landfills that we have. We used to have about 8,000 landfills about 15 years ago. We have about 2,000 now. So you think that's a good thing. But the size of the landfills has increased 25 times. So the average landfill used to have a million-ton capacity. Now it's 25 million tons. And because of efficiencies, we're able to either recycle some of that or incinerate it. So it doesn't take up as much space. It's much more compact. But if you were to stack it all together, all the landfills, it would eclipse the state of Pennsylvania. So we have a pretty big, problem on our hands. And increasingly so as there's less space for us as people just to inhabit the land when we need a lot of it to grow things in order to survive. So when you start infringing upon our own space here, what do you do with it? You ship it other places. We ship 85% of the electronic waste that we have, computers, cell phones, batteries, light bulbs, to third world countries.
Let's go to Jeff in Canada. Jeff, you're on with Thomas Costigan. Go ahead.
George, thank you very much. Just for your edification, I live in a small city called Orillia that's just north of Toronto.
Okay.
And I happen to be the treasurer for the Waste Management Advisory Committee for the city of Orillia, which is a volunteer position. And for the last 17 years, it has taken me 8 to 9 months to generate one conventional garbage can full of garbage. That because I actually looked at my lifestyle and I said, what is it that I should be doing to be a non-contributor to the degradation of our planet? And the thing is that the fact that there's all this crap out in the Pacific, it comes from somewhere. And so many people think, it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and they have no comprehension whatsoever as to the minuscule effect of what they do in a cumulative way, and this is what it results in, is this concentration in the Pacific.
Jeff, you just said something that is so important.
Yep.
Thomas, out of sight, out of mind.
That's
people,
right.
People don't see it physically other than it's been tossed away and it floats away or whatever. They feel there's no problem anymore.
And George, I'm only 3 years younger than you, and I do not have any children. But the thing is that I act constantly as to how would it be if I did have children or grandchildren, and it's the principle that the native communities of North America have always had, and that is the seven generation. And the principle is, what are you doing today that will affect seven generations from now? And when you understand that you're not separate from, but part of nature, and you're part of what the situation is, whatever you do now is going to affect your great, 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 great grandchildren.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. Thomas, who are the biggest offenders countrywide?
Well, I just want to salute that last gentleman because he's
absolutely
dead on with exactly what he's saying. And, you know, the biggest offenders are us as individuals. We now produce twice as much waste per person as we did 20 years ago. About 5 pounds a day of trash we're each responsible for. And here's where the out-of-sight, out-of-mind thing is, because we lay it off on other people. We end up saying, okay, I recycled, that's a good thing. And we forget, well, could I reduce my consumption first, or can I reuse whatever that thing is that I just tossed in the recycle bin? If we start to think about reducing and reusing before we recycle, we'll be in a much better position. And here is why. We are contributing to about 30% of the pollution in China because of our consumption habits. We buy so many goods from China, we're responsible for 30% of its pollution. So when we start to, and that's retail goods for consumers, that's not business to business. That's not any government contracts. That's what we as consumers purchase, and we're responsible for that. Walmart alone is China's eighth largest trading partner. So we forget that we have a role in this. And when we start to look at buying locally and buying made in the USA items, we're in a much better position because we don't have all the transportation energy that goes along with this, and often we don't, if we buy from fresh farmers markets, for example, we don't have a lot of the packaging. And packaging is an enormous, enormous problem. Each and every person in the United States consumes enough plastic just by their purchases, all that packaging, to weigh about 200 pounds. 60 pounds of that is just wasted packaging that we throw away. So we don't really think through a lot of our consumption habits. We don't really, you know, do we need that extra plastic bag? Do we even need a plastic bag? You know, what are we doing in our own lives where we can reduce first and then reuse maybe that plastic water bottle? We use about 81 million plastic water bottles on a daily basis in the United States. If everyone who did that just refilled it once, we'd save a billion pounds of plastic from going to the landfills.
And it sounds like the jury's out on whether those are even safe for us, Thomas.
Oh, my God. Yeah, if you look at the news over the last week, it's crazy.
You are here. Where do you get the book?
You can go onto the website, www.readyouarehere.com. All sorts of candy free, including videos. Or you can go to any major bookstore and pick it up.
One more quick call. Joel in Florida. About 40 seconds, Joel. Go for it.
Hi, it's a pleasure. It's an honor. You were speaking of China. I saw a report. I can't quite remember where I saw this, but in a region in China, the waters are so polluted that the ducks are actually growing feet like chickens. They're not growing webs.
Yes, you are absolutely right. We had a picture, Joel, of that duck with chicken feet. And again, it's part of this environmental disaster. Thomas, thanks for being on the program. Good luck with this work. You are here. I'll be back in a moment as we begin our roundtable discussion about the bailout on Coast to Coast AM.